Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you today?
I am fine. Cold, but fine, other than that.
Yeah, it looks like you're a little wrapped up. I mean, it is chilly here, too. I do have the heat turned up a little bit, that I'm not wearing a sweatshirt, but it's still the first part of March in Pennsylvania, so this happens.
So it's moody. If anybody lives in other parts of the world, Pennsylvania's moody. I'm telling you, without any reservation, you can have a 30, 40, and even 50 degree change in an entire day. You can get up and we'll start out in a parka, end up in a pair of shorts for the afternoon, and back to your parka by 10 o'clock at night.
That's a fact. Up until May.
Yeah. It's just moody. Like 10 minutes ago, there was a blizzard outside. I couldn't see anything. Now the sun's shining.
I don't have sun, but and at least our snow stopped, but it's like 38 degrees. So it's, that's Fahrenheit, folks. Sorry if you're in the Celsius world, that's about 4 or 5 Celsius. So, anyway, I would like to thank anyone who is new. Thank you for joining us. Please click the like and subscribe if you are so inclined to do so. If you are a return, member? Can't say member. We don't really have memberships, but if we call you members, you're family. And if you're returning, we thank you for coming back again. If you look at the description down below the episode on whatever type of platform you're looking at, you'll find all of our links to pretty much everything paranormalist related. And with that, what is our topic today?
Well, we're going to the cemetery. And tell now, some graveyard ghost stories.
We were there last weekend. We were there for a snack.
But that was ghouls. These are just
we were there for ghosts. A snack.
Yes, we had snacks last weekend. So I don't know. I was started out to do one on haunted asylums, and for some reason I got rerouted and sidetracked, and this is where I ended up, which happens to me quite a lot. Y'all have no clue. And started looking at these really cool ghost stories, and I thought, I want to share these with everybody. Some of them are funny, some of them are sweet, some of them are really creepy. And the first thing I learned is that there's the difference between a cemetery and a graveyard. I did not know there was a difference.
Is it a fence?
No, it is a cemetery is in is attached to a churchyard, and it's consecrated ground. A graveyard is just a plot of land that's usually publicly owned, like the government maybe runs a cemetery, or they lease a piece of a graveyard, or they put one up for the use of the town. I didn't know that.
Yeah, in this region, I believe they're used interchangeably, if not incorrectly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I did not know that. I thought that they were pretty much like they were just synonymous with each other. But one is consecrated ground and one is not consecrated ground. And of course, that would play back to certain religious beliefs and certain social beliefs and what have you. So. But I thought I would start up and tell some of these stories. So I came across this one. This was actually the very first story I found, and I did it kind of differently. I just sort of put them together, other than a couple at the end that I rearranged because I thought they were really interesting in a certain order. The first cemetery we're going to visit is Greenwood Cemetery in Decatur, Illinois. It is a really interesting cemetery. So first of all, the European settlers came there in about the 1820s, and there was this area where the cemetery lies was already a Native American burial ground. It had been for a long time. So when whites started coming into the area, they had to find a place to bury their dead too. And so it sort of became a shared burial ground for about 10 years. And then over the course of time, religious beliefs and who has what and the concept of owner, all those things came into play. And, and eventually the whites took over the cemetery and There is no mention that they desecrated any graves. There's no mention that they destroyed anything, but they took it over and the natives went elsewhere. This all kind of came about because of a series of events. So what basically happened is in 1828, there were these bootleggers. Now, I want to talk a couple seconds about bootlegging. It matters to the story. People think bootlegging is just alcohol. But in early America, alcohol equaled money and trading power for most people. So if you lived in a rural area in the middle of nowhere in frontier land, you didn't have cash or much cash. The country is still being put together. Please remember that. Like, it wasn't like we won the American Revolutionary War and bam, Washington, D.C. suddenly rose up out of the ground. There's a 10-year period, there was no president. Congress, the head of Congress ran the country. And every single area had its own separate currency. So literally you could go to Bedford County, PA and Hagerstown, Maryland, and one has a blue currency, the other's pink, and you know, and they couldn't be interchangeable. So the only thing you could do is barter. And in frontier times and in frontier land, that's important. So when people hear stories, they go, oh, they were just terrible bootleggers. Please understand that we're talking about here in this story is people's only livelihood. Because that's exactly what we're talking about. It's the same thing that caused the Whiskey Rebellion in Western Pennsylvania, is they wanted to tax alcohol, and alcohol was their currency. So then they were like, you know, you have to give us a percentage of your currency, or you can't sell your currency, which was trading alcohol for food and supplies. This is what happened in Decatur, Illinois. So these gentlemen who were making moonshine, and we're using it to sell and barter with. And we come across a group of Indians, Native Americans, who are checking the place out. Now, why they were checking it out, they obviously, we don't know, because it didn't work out well for them. So they got run off. During the ensuing argument, there was a gun battle. The natives were killed and they were buried in their burial ground area in a shallow grave, which still exists to this day, by the way. Like, there's, you can still go there and see the opening and the whole nine yards. Like, they were buried. But that kind of put the kibosh to any kind of getting along. And that's what caused everybody to separate. And that's kind of important because that's our first ghost story. Yep. So the story goes that throughout time, there have been a lot of people who have encountered a group of Native American men who are very angry and upset, who are apparently, sometimes it looks like they're fighting an invisible foe. Sometimes you just hear the sounds. It depends on the encounter, but there have been almost 200 years of stories of unrest, screams, pain, you know, those kind of things going on, or actually seeing them come running out of the grave or coming running out of the woods near the grave, things like that. And so that's our very first ghost story. And again, I thought that when I read the story originally, I was like, we have no idea in today's culture what this story was really about, because it's not about give me your land. It was about don't take the money I have to feed my family. And that's where the cultural clash came in this particular story. By 1850, this area of ground was called a corpse garden. I had not heard that one before. So it didn't become a cemetery or a graveyard until much later. It was referred to locally in the papers as the corpse garden. And I was like, huh, that's a new one. Hadn't heard that one before. Well, I guess in a lot of ways, I guess it was. They planted corpses there.
That's very literal.
It is very literal. And of course, you know, we go up forward to the 1920s. And in the 1920s, there were a lot of stories that suddenly came out about unrest and seeing the dead moving, particularly the Native Americans that I told you about just a minute ago. By the 50s, this area is completely abandoned. The cemetery is in ruins. Nobody's hanging out there. It's in really bad shape. But it's also a good place if you're a criminal to go hang out, have meetings, you know, pass whatever it is you're passing, drugs, alcohol, whatever. So in this old broken down cemetery, this is what it became. It became a hangout for the criminals in the area. The cops weren't going there. They weren't looking for you. It was a good place for all of that. They could trade goods. Now, this is the end of Prohibition. It's right before the end of the Prohibition. So, you know, there's a lot of alcohol being passing back and forth. For anybody who's not from the United States, just to like give you a thumbnail, in the United States passed a bill in Congress at one point that we outlaw forbid alcohol. And all that did is make for a huge drinking party for the next 40, 50 years. Everybody was making illegal hooch and selling it. And it really is what created the gangsters of Chicago and, you know, and all of that, Al Capone and all of that. They made their money off of that particular law and breaking it. So it's a substantial amount of money that was passing hands back and forth in the cemetery at the time period. And there's this really interesting story that we're going to come to that'll bring that that up. And so there's in 1930, so this is part of the Prohibition area, there's a young couple who fall in love. And because the cemetery is abandoned, they start meeting there. They start meeting there because the young lady comes from a very upstanding family. It's a little Romeo and Juliet story, if you will. And the young fella comes from a family that makes their money off of hooch, which is illegal bootleg whiskey. And her family feels that she can do a lot better and they don't want criminals in the bloodline. So they forbid her to meet this young man, but she's madly in love. So they go, they start meeting in the cemetery in the middle of the night and she'll go back home and, you know, before first light and blah, blah, blah. And they come up with this plan to elope, because once the deed is done, ain't be undone, is how they were looking at it. And he says to her, you know, on a specific night, they settle on a night, come here to the cemetery, meet me at this spot, this their rendezvous spot, and I won't be able to get here till about 1:30, 2 o'clock, so don't be worried, I can't meet you till way after midnight. She's like, okay. He's like, but be here by midnight just in case, you know, I'll get here as soon as I can. So on the night that they was appointed, they split up and she went to the cemetery and he went off. What he didn't tell her was he had one last good-sized shipment of alcohol to sell. So he had money to start over somewhere else, pay for the wedding and all that. And that's what was holding him up. Unfortunately for him and her, there was a rival who knew about what was going on, knew about the alcohol shipment and how lucrative it would be. And the fella ambushed this young man and shot him multiple times and then took his body and dumped it in the river. So she waits all night and obviously nobody comes, heartbroken, not sure what's going on. She goes home. She waits a few days. She can't find him. He doesn't talk to her. She can't find any information. His people say they don't know where he's at. And eventually the word spreads and a body was found in the river by some fishermen. And it turns out to be her fella. Well, that's bad enough, but she can't handle it. So a few nights after the funeral, she goes to the river and she jumps off a bridge and she decides to join him. She's buried in the same cemetery, not in the same area, but they're both buried in the same cemetery, this cemetery. And they say that you'll see her walking along to the rendezvous spot, still waiting for the young man. And I thought the saddest part of that story was that they're there. They could meet, they could, you know, wherever they're at, they're in the same spot. But their grief is such that neither one of them's finding the other. And that's a truly a tragedy. But that is a very well-known story. And many people have encountered this over the years. Usually it's people there late at night, probably for nefarious reasons, although with ghost hunters and stuff like that these days, it could definitely be for other reasons. But that is one of the interesting stories. The last one I wanted to tell from this particular cemetery is about the Weeping Woman of Barrackman Steps. So Barrackman was the name of a family. And this cemetery is out in the woods. So there's, you know, out in the countryside. So there's these little rolling hills and these little gullies and divots and what have you. And on one of these little hills, there's, it's like a knob, really. There's five graves and a little set of concrete steps that go up to the graves. So you can not have to climb the hill. You can take the stairs instead. There is a woman who has been seen. She's always seen in the late afternoon, always before dusk. She's standing on the steps looking at the five graves. Her head is bowed and she is crying. You can hear her softly crying. Mm-hmm. When people approach her to ask if she's okay, she never looks up. She just fades away. And she's been seen many times because, interestingly, you know, she's not an after the midnight kind of ghost. This is like people there in the afternoon, they're paying their respects and that's the last thing they think they're going to see. And so they walk up to this lady who seems to be grieving, really grieving hard and want to be a comfort, which makes this a really interesting story because you don't get many daylight ghost stories like that. Now, one of the other things that's in this cemetery that is interesting is there's something called a mourning chair. If you go to cemeteries today, there's not a whole lot of these, but at one time there were chairs set at the foot or benches set at the foot of graves. And, you know, like maybe a little family plot that would have a bench or a little chair sitting there for somebody could sit and rest and do their mourning. And so the family would put one in and it's called a mourning chair. But this particular mourning chair, and there's a lot of them that have been removed because of stories and the kind of things that go on. This one's still there. And this one has an interesting tale behind it. So the story is that if you sit in this mourning chair that and you wait until way after dark, that out of the darkness will appear a figure, a male. And the male will come up to you and he will say, I want to talk to you. Will you make a deal with me? And he tells them, I will give you anything you want for the next 7 years. Anything at all, fame, fortune, family, whatever you want, it's yours. At the end of the 7 years, I will collect your soul. Now think about it, you're distraught, you're miserable, you're not thinking clearly. And this figure comes up, and there are stories that people have made the deal, if you will. And so the chair is believed to be cursed because within because, you know, people have supposedly made the deal. Now, there's another piece of folklore about this chair and about most of these chairs that if you sit in them, you're doomed or will have bad luck. If you actually sit in them and you're not part of that family, or that within 12 months of sitting in the chair, you will pass away yourself for desecrating a family's mourning chair. I had no idea that it was, you know, taken quite that literally, but apparently it is. This is a cemetery that has so many ghost stories. It's insane. There's also was a mausoleum in the Greenwood Cemetery. It was built in 1908 and was torn down in 1967. So the mausoleum was really badly built. Like it was shoddy workmanship from end to end. It didn't take long until they're starting to get cracks in it and water was leaking down the walls and into the crypts where the bodies were at, what have you. And people were pretty upset. You know, you spend a lot of money to buy a slip in a mausoleum for your beloved loved ones. And over time, it just got worse and worse. Eventually, in the 1950s, it was decided it was so unsafe that they needed to shut it down completely. So in 1957, they completely shut it down, stating they were afraid the walls were going to collapse in or ceiling tiles would fall. You know, hunks of concrete were falling out of the walls. It was really bad. Now, in order to move all these bodies, which were several hundred bodies that were in this mausoleum, they had to contact all the families. They attempted to contact the families of the dead and say, you know, we're going to have to tear this down. It's no longer adequate. It's not safe. Where would you like your loved ones interred? Can you make arrangements? Now, this was complicated for some of the dead there because there were incomplete records found. So well over 100 people were not identified and no family member came forward despite multiple attempts at publishing the need to, you know, find the next of kin, the loved ones for people in this mausoleum. And, you know, they did newspaper articles, TV articles asking, you know, if you had a family member interred here, please reach out to us. We, you know, we need to talk to you. So well over 100 bodies are left at the end of this. They tear down the mausoleum and they take the bodies just across the road to an open site and they make three mass graves. Because they don't know who these people are. So they just decide to put them in mass graves. They can't give you any kind of a record to say that here's where so-and-so are buried. So it just seemed like the most expedient answer. Just put them in mass graves, they're reinterred, and move forward. That's whenever it started. People started talking about hearing whispers, crying, yells, screams, talking, coming from the mass graves and the site where the mausoleum had been. So you can imagine you're walking down to put flowers on Aunt Rose's grave and you're in the cemetery by yourself and all of a sudden you hear, "Oh, happy, please," you know, and then screams of pain or agony. And at first everybody thought it was just active imaginations and what have you. But over time, many people heard it. And cemetery employees heard it. Mourners heard it. People that were there groundskeeping heard it. It became a very common thing. And something else became fairly common as well. Balls of white or blue light would appear at night coming out of the mass graves and float up in the air, cross the road, and hit the tombstones around the outside of the area that was still empty, that was where the mausoleum had set. Or they would rise up out of the mausoleum ground and head toward where the mass graves are. And they were either white or blue balls of light. They were never any other color. And they literally bounced. That's the word they used in the articles I read. They bounced on the tombstones.
Indicating mass.
They bounced on the tombstones. That was interesting. So the last group of ghosts in this cemetery, which is really haunted, obviously, are called the Phantom Soldiers. So during the Civil War, there was a group of two trains that would take Confederate soldiers that were dead, and they were Southern prisoners of war. They had mostly died from yellow fever, some from, you know, starvation, other medical care that was withheld or just couldn't be performed because of the masses of soldiers that were involved. And they would be taken to mass graves. This was where a great many of them were placed. They were placed in mass graves in this cemetery as well, in one little section. The grave was not marked. So we just know from the record, the historical record, that this happened. We don't know exactly where they are. Something insane happens. Fast forward years and years. So they decide to put a marker, the Cemetery Association decides to put a marker to honor the fallen Union soldiers who are buried in the cemetery. And whether it's intentional or not, I don't know, but they plunk it square on top of the mass grave of the Confederate soldiers.
Bad form.
In every way. Like if it was knowingly, willingly done, it's just a trashy act. But that's exactly what happened. After that, people started talking about hearing screams, cries, yelling for help from that mass grave. And interestingly enough, many people started talking about seeing young men who appeared ill or emaciated, and they were coming from the river, which makes sense because eventually it comes out that some of the bodies of these dead Confederate soldiers were washed out in a flood and then just shoved in someplace and never put back in the grave where, you know, I'm sure some of their body parts are there and some are some in this other spot where they shoved them in. And there's a story about this young man. He's about 10-year-old boy. And he's at the back of the cemetery. There's a wood lot and his home is on the other side of this wood lot. So he's out in the wood lot and he's goofing off. He's been out there many, many times. He's lived there his whole life and he's never thought about it. And one day he's out there and this young man in gray clothes with what appeared to be dark spots, and he said it looked like dried blood, steps out from behind a tree. And he appears startled by seeing the boy and confused. And he said, and this is interesting because of a story I have from Gettysburg. When I read it, I had chills. Are you ready? He ready. Said, I don't ready. Know where I am, and I just want to get home. The boy looked at him to tell him where he was, and the figure faded away in that moment. Now, because our listeners may not know the story, I'm very going to quickly going to tell them the story from the Devil's Den. So Devil's Den in Gettysburg was a very tragic area of serious fighting, a lot of really awful, bloody, gory things occurred at Devil's Den. Years and years ago, when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I was in Gettysburg to do a book signing with my friend and historian, Mark Nesbitt. It was the 4th of July weekend, anniversary of the battle, and this young lady comes into the bookstore where we were at, and she looks sick, like she's going to like just lose it. She's shaking all over. There's tears running down her face, like she's almost hysterical. And she starts pacing back and forth, pacing back and forth. She gets in my line, she gets in Mark's line, she gets back in my line, she goes to the back of the room and stands for a little bit, gets in line, like she can't decide what to do. And then finally, the group of tourists go through we were talking to, and I ask her, can I help you? And she starts to cry, and she tells this crazy story that she just got married, her husband's like into Gettysburg stuff, and she was bored to tears, and they were at Devil's Den. And there's these huge giant rocks at Devil's Den that everybody climbs up on the top of. And she was like, it was hot. It was miserable. I was bored. I wanted to go to the car and get the air conditioning on. So she left and went to the car, parked at the far side of the den. As she's walking towards the car, a young soldier in Confederate clothes comes out. He looks like a boy of about 17, 18. And she stops and looks at him for a second and she says, excuse me. At which point he says, can you see me, ma'am? Ma'am, can you tell them that I just want to go home and see my mama? And he starts crying and telling her this crazy story. And she's thinking, wow, he's really good. Like, it's intense. And if there's a lot of reenactors, and if you go to Gettysburg, you will see reenactors who are phenomenal actors who will portray a character. And they will do it with that kind of passion. So that was her first thought, not dead guy. And he tells her his name is Timmy Wells. He's from the 104th Texas. And or Tennessee, excuse me, 104th Tennessee. And he's fighting with the Texans up on the hill. All of this turns out to be true. That there is this group of soldiers. They were from Tennessee. That they did fight with the Texans up on the hill, which is right above Devil's Tennis, little and big round top. They were from that little round top. And she just thinks he's so good. And then he reaches down, pulls a little fake flower off of a display. And he says, and he looks at her and he's trying to talk to her. This older man comes out of the woods. He's darker hair, kind of unshaven. And he screams, Timmy. Got that deep southern accent. Timmy, we gotta go now, boy. And Timmy looks at her and he pulls that flower off that display and he hands it to her and he says, I gotta go now, ma'am. You've been a peach of a belle. And he starts running toward the older gentleman and they both fade away. All he wanted to do was go home and see his mama. And when I saw this, I said, all I want to do is go home. I thought, wow, that is so close to what I've had this woman experience. I just thought it was a phenomenal story and it makes perfect sense. He just wants to go home. And that's what these guys are doing. They're still trying to find their way home. It's a tragic tale, but it's a fascinating story. So we're going to visit next Union Graveyard in Stepton Road, Easton area of Connecticut. This was actually Ed and Lorraine Warren wrote a lot about this particular cemetery. It had a ton of ghost stories attached. So it was built in the late 1700s, and one of the stories is about this elusive white woman who was seen multiple times. She was seen running down the road towards this little church right by the cemetery, and she would run towards the church. There's this amazing story where two guys were driving down the road, and they see her come out of nowhere. And before they can stop, they hit her. And they hit her so hard, she saw it. That's the interesting part to me about this. Because you hear ghost stories all the time where they hit somebody and they go straight through them. But right. She saw it. They hit her so hard, the back end of the car lifts up. It's like hitting a wall. And then they pass on through. They pull the car off. And they're like, oh my God, we just killed somebody. So one of them gets on the phone and calls for help. The other gets out to see if there's any aid they can render to this poor woman that they just struck. A woman in what they called a white nightgown. There's nobody there. They look everywhere. There's no damage to the car. Which is insane, because if you hit something hard enough to jack the back end, you hit something hard enough to smash the front end.
Sure.
There's another story in the 19 about a guy in 1993 whose name was Glenn Powell. He was called out there for a transformer, and it was blowing, it had been hit by lightning, and it was just blowing fire and what have you, and the whole area was just lit up pink with this flame from this transformer. That's when they saw her too. He describes her as a woman in white with long flowing hair. The police officer who was with him on the call saw her as well. They hit her. They have the same experience.
Wow.
Smacking into her hard enough, they thought they killed her. And the police officer gets out to render aid. This guy, Glenn Powell, is trying to get to the transformer to get it stopped before it catches a forest fire or something. And again, there was nobody. But they actually filed a police report because they were that convinced they actually hit somebody. And there is a story that in the 1940s, there was a woman who killed her husband, and then she hung herself in the cemetery. And they believe that the lady in white is her. She's always described as in a white nightgown and wearing, she has long brown hair. And like she said, she's been seen standing in front of the church. She's been seen coming out of the church, at 10 or 11 or 12 o'clock at night. You're driving by and a lady in a nightgown standing in front of the church steps. That's in the middle of nowhere. That's kind of geared to catch your attention. Mm-hmm. There was a Lorraine Warren went there. She was particularly interested in this particular thing. So it was they've been there for 7 nights in a row filming in the cemetery, trying to find proof of some of the stuff that goes on in this cemetery. And they talk about these red eyes that rose up out of the woods right by the edge of the cemetery. And they moved through the cemetery at the height of a man, just eyes. And they went across the road where they blinked out. And doing research, the Warrens found that there have been multiple sightings of these red eyes. Now, just to clarify one point, there was a lot of teenagers at one point that were hanging out in the cemetery because, it's a haunted cemetery. You can dare your girl and, have a little canooch. And so the local cemetery association put up these red reflectors all through the cemetery, which were creepy at night. But that said, here's the other half of that story. These red reflectors don't walk. They don't bounce. They don't move with the gait of a human being. And they don't go into an open area across the road from the cemetery where it's completely open. There's no woods. It's just mowed grass and blink out. Doing research, the Warrens found out that in 1935, there was a man who was set on fire.
Oh.
where those lights blinked out. It was in the newspaper accounts. So that's a pretty, I mean, it's obviously a correlation. It's not exact, but it's a pretty interesting story. Our next visit is going to be the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Hollywood has a couple really haunted cemeteries, and a lot of times they're haunted by, let's see, I'm trying to think. Marilyn Monroe supposedly haunts the cemetery where she's buried in a mausoleum, and she supposedly has been seen standing beside the little square area where her placard is. She's appeared to many people over the course of time, things like that. But this one's, I just thought this was really interesting because the first ghost story is actually one that started out looking like it could be solved. So for those who don't know, Rudolph Valentino was America's very first heartthrob in the 1930s, like 1920s and 30s. There's not even anybody I can think of to compare him to today. We don't have actors that we revere like that. Like, women were fainting when they'd see him on a screen, and they would scream and pull their hair out. It was insane. It was literally mass hysteria. So when he died in the age of 31 in 1926, 100,000 people gathered outside the funeral parlor where he was laid out. 100,000. I can't even imagine. There's even some stories that say that they didn't have his body on display. It was a wax figure because they were afraid that these young women would go insane, and they didn't want the desecration. So the family had him privately held back elsewhere, and they put this public display on for the mourning of the public that adored him. So, however, he was buried at that cemetery, and they actually had to have guards watch the cemetery. It's insane, but that people wouldn't dig it up and take souvenirs or, things like that. So, they were concerned about desecrating the grave, tearing the tombstone up. There was all kinds of craziness. I can't even stress to you how nuts this was. People committed suicide when he died because there's no reason to live if he's not here. It's insane. I'm serious. It's just absolutely insane. And so anyhow, after this happened, it becomes every year on the anniversary of his death, a woman in a black dress, a very thin woman in a black dress, would come to the cemetery. She wore a black veil over her face so nobody could see her, and she would lay roses on his grave. And then she would just walk away. She didn't pause for very long. She just laid him on the grave and left. Well, this went on for 50 years or more. Just insane. Over the course of time, cemetery staff started talking about the lady in black and who is she and, blah, blah, blah. At first, they thought it was Paula Negri, who had been his fiance. They were planning to get married, but it turned out it wasn't her. She wasn't even in the area when this happened. And then there were others who voluntarily came out and said, hey, it's me, but it didn't pan out. And there was one, however, her name was Dietra Flame, who said she was the woman in black. She was 78 years old when she died and when she revealed her truth. So I don't think she did it for fame, because she was kind of a deathbed type thing. She said when she was 14, she was told many times she was deathly ill, and several times Valentino, as a favor to her mother, whom he had known, would go to her hospital bed and place a rose in her hand and say, you're going to be okay. Don't forget, you're going to be okay. You're not going to die. She said, and this is a quote, she said, he told me, you're not going to die at all. You are going to live for many more years, but one thing for sure, if I die before you do, please come and stand by me, because I don't want to be alone. Which made me want to cry. Huh. So when she got better and Valentino died, she paid back this act of kindness for the rest of her life by doing this. And some say she's still paying it back from the dead, because on the anniversary of his death, somehow mysteriously, this woman in black appears and lays a rose on his grave. And no matter who's watching, no matter how they try to catch her, she somehow manages to avoid them until the last second when they find the rose and she fades away. And I thought that was a beautiful story. Who knew? Like, I've heard the story of Valentino and the Lady in Black, but I didn't. I actually found a newspaper article from the New York Times where they interviewed her right prior to her death. And she finally told the story to lay all those rumors to rest. And I just loved that story. And if she's still going there, I see why. As he did a great act of kindness for her when she needed him, and she paid it back beautifully. So we're going to go on to a young lady by the name of Virginia Rapay. On Labor Day of 1921, there was an actor by the name of Roscoe Arbuckle, who was at that time one of the most famous actors of all time. He had just received, this is a huge amount of money in this time frame, 1921. He had just received a three-picture deal for $3 million. And so he decided to throw a party. And I know you're nodding. I'm wondering, I was shocked by some of the stuff I have since learned. So he threw a party at a place called the St. Francis Hotel, where Virginia was one of the people invited. She got sick. Now, the story that I have read, even in like crime historical documentary books, is that he was this horrible sex fiend who raped her with a bottle and then ruptured her bladder, and she died days later from these injuries. But that may not be true. So here's what I learned. So she did get sick at the party, and she went home. A few days later, she died. Nobody looked at Arbuckle at the beginning. Nobody. They weren't at all convinced at all. Everybody who knew him said he was a really nice man. I listened to interviews of people who came forward in the last few years, because they're now old enough that it doesn't matter that they tell the truth. They claim that because one of her friends made a comment, it was probably that crazy ass, basically Arbuckle. Who knows? He might even have raped her with a Coke bottle. And that's exactly how it was said. He might even have. A reporter took it and ran with it. And the studio that owned his contract decided he was too much of a liability, so they hung him out to dry. They were people who knew where he was at that night, people who were character witnesses for him that were in the industry, were all told, say one word and you'll never work in Hollywood again. They have come out to tell the story now. Now, he went through three trials. He was never convicted. And he lost everything. He couldn't even work for like 11 years. He had to go back east. He took other jobs. He wanted to go back into acting because he loved it. He did a couple little shorts, and then he died of a heart attack. But I had no idea that this was literally the studios decided to hang him out, and they were going to just tear him up, throw him away. It was cheaper and easier than, you know, trying to defend this guy, because it was a terrible scandal. So they literally threatened people. If you stand up for him, if you tell them that you knew where he was at the moment, that he had never, you know, done anything to her, we will fire you and make sure you never work again.
Yeah, I had just read that story very recently.
That's crazy, and, isn't it?
I had heard it when I was younger too, but didn't realize it. I knew he was blackballed and in Hollywood, but it was just, yeah.
Yeah. So young Virginia was buried in the cemetery here. And there are people who claim they see her standing at the edge of the water, not too far from her grave. There's a little pond, and she's dressed in the clothing from the 1920s, and she's weeping. And people ask if, you know, if she's weeping because she knows what happened to this guy, because he was a friend of hers. Arbuckle was a friend of hers. That's why he invited her. And, or is she crying because she lost her life so young? But she is definitely mourning something. And I had no idea. I've been hearing a lot of, and I haven't been trying to, but recently several stories of like these great big Paramount different companies that hung out actors to dry the same way. Like they just, they're like, you know, shut up. We'll give your family money. You're going to jail. We want you out of the way. We don't want that, that image, even though they knew the guy was innocent and they knew this guy was innocent. He had people who knew where he was that knew he couldn't have done it because he wasn't where they say he was. And there was this one lady I watched an interview with her, and she said, she stood up as a character witness for him, and she said, I want to make sure you understand I never worked again. It's something. It's an amazing story. And just, apparently she's still grieving. One way or the other, she's still grieving. So we're going to go on to another cemetery. I love these stories. Some of them are really interesting, and some of them are very unusual. St. Louis Cemetery in New Orleans. So this is a cemetery that was started in the mid-1700s. It was burned down in 1788. So for those who don't know, New Orleans is below sea level. So they bury their dead above the ground. If concrete crypts and what have you, and they bury their dead above ground. And apparently it was one of the graveyards that was originally opened, and then it was caught on fire, set on fire on purpose by somebody to destroy the cemetery in 1788. However, this is interesting. They think it was because whoever owned the other public cemetery, so there was the cemetery, you know, St. Louis Cemetery, another St. Louis cemetery opens up down the road, and it's owned by somebody different. And suddenly the St. Louis Cemetery from 1880 that was open prior to 1888 catches fire, and all those graves are desecrated. The people of the town decide it's this other guy who opens the second St. Louis Cemetery, so they burn his cemetery down in 1789, the next year. And then they rebuild the original cemetery. So a lot of drama. To date, there's over 100,000 people interred in the cemetery. There are, I want to put this in perspective. The cemetery is about the size of a city block. 100,000 bodies.
That's dense.
Exceedingly dense. It is known to be haunted. There are people who claim that they encounter what they describe as angry ghosts walking around as though they were trying to finish their business. So we'll ask questions like, you know, how do you get to such and such a spot? And somebody will go to answer them, and then they'll just disappear. So they seem to be upset about all the distrust and the unrest around their graves. But the most popular tomb in the entire thing is that of Marie Laveau. So Marie Laveau's mother was a great voodoo priestess, and Marie Laveau herself became a great voodoo priestess. And she is known for having done some amazing conjures. She put curses on people. She was so rich because everybody, the aristocracy, everybody sought out Marie Laveau. She would sell you a love potion, and the guy that you loved would, you know, would suddenly ask you to marry him. She would curse you, somebody for you, and that person would die, and you would get that job or that political seat. She earned a huge reputation. And to this day, there are people who believe that she will grant wishes and help you from the dead. So they go to her tomb and they ask her for a wish. And then they make three X's in chalk on the tomb to seal the deal. And it is their belief that they will get their wish. So if you go down there, you'll see all kinds of beads and all kinds of juju and gris-gris items from voodoo culture. You'll see tons of X's all over the place. The tombstone's disfigured from the number of X's, or the tomb itself is disfigured. But it is believed she still haunts there, that she's still a viable power, and that she is still working for the living for a price. You do have to leave her something in return. And I thought that was she's very famous. If you go into voodoo and stuff, she's probably the most famous American voodoo priestess of all time. And so there's a lot of stories about her. And she was very, very wealthy, because I'm not exaggerating at all when I tell you high class, like state and federal politicians would pay her to put curses on their opponents and stuff like that. Massive amounts of money.
Yikes.
And they claimed it worked. There's amazing. Maybe we'll, if the listeners are interested, let me know and we'll do an episode that touches a little bit more on Marie Laveau and her amazing life. It's an interesting story. So the next place we're going to is Boot Hill in Tombstone, Arizona. I have to tell you, it is the most unpretentious cemetery. It is literally just a scrabble of little graves and tombstones. And some of them are like cordoned off with little iron pipes. There's nothing huge and unique and grand about the cemetery. And the reason it's called Boot Hill is because they would normally take your boots off to bury you. But in Boot Hill, so many people died and had to be buried so quickly due to the gun fighting and the arguing and all this stuff that was going on. They just buried you with your boots on. And it wasn't until, I mean, there are stories that go for great distances of time where people claim they saw so-and-so in the cemetery and then they followed this person and the person disappeared or person appeared in front of them, what have you. But it's only whenever, with the advent of the 1960s and 70s and photography getting really popular with the common people, that the stories of Tombstone Cemetery began to really take hold. So basically what would happen is people would go there for the history or the ghost stories or whatever, and they would go to the Tombstone Cemetery, which is infamous, made infamous by, you know, certain historical events, and they would want a relative or a friend or somebody to take a picture of them and, you know, standing with that iconic gate that says Tombstone Cemetery, right? And that's whenever this started to take off, because people would take the photographs, and when they would get them developed, there would be a ghost of a cowboy rising out of the ground right beyond that beautiful, iconic gate.
I've seen some of those. Mm-hmm.
They're really interesting, yeah. Aren't they?
They are, yeah.
And there's a story about a journalist who traveled there to check the place out. He was just interested. He was standing in front of what was just an unmarked grave, and just said, you know, here's a grave. We know it's here. We don't know who it is. And he said, I heard a voice saying, you were so nice for doing that. He was absolutely flabbergasted by what he saw. And he said, gotta go. And the voice said, you came back. That means you like to play with me. He said, I got scared all over and numb. And I started to run, and I'll never go back. He said the interesting thing to him was that he had never been there before. Maybe he looked like somebody else. I don't know. I'm going to fast. We have so many of these. This one here I thought was really interesting. So there is this place called the Haunted Chinese Graveyard. And it is, interestingly enough, not in an area where a lot of Oriental people had lived. It's actually in Texas, and it's in San Antonio, and it dates, you know, back to the early 1900s. And the story behind the cemetery is that there's actually a descendant of the man who started the cemetery who tells the story. And he said his uncle had fallen in love with an Oriental lady, and because they were forbidden by the family. His family didn't want him to marry this young woman because she was from a different nationality. So there was a lot of trouble, a lot of goings on. And they would meet at this area, which is now the Chinese graveyard. And the young man would ride his horse out and meet her there. And one night he was riding his horse out to meet her. It was literally a stormy night. And he says that his great uncle got hit by lightning and died. And the family found out about her going to meet him at nights in this area and what have you. Eventually, they placed his grave there, and it became the family plot. She would go there every evening and sit by his grave for the rest of her time, until she committed suicide at the grave of a couple years later. Because of her faithfulness, his family was really moved, and they felt horrible for what they had done to this couple. They buried her and him together, side by side, and it became the Guzman Family Cemetery, although the local people called it the Chinese graveyard. They call it that because a woman 7 foot tall of Oriental descent is seen there, or they will see what's believed to be this young woman who is much more petite, rising up out of her grave and standing there still grieving for her lost love. And it literally is a family cemetery to this day. So you can't trespass, but you can see it. It says on the sign, the Guzman Family Cemetery. I just thought it was an interesting story. There's also another story about the place, which is called the Donkey Lady story. And it's just believed that there was a woman of Oriental descent, Chinese descent, who was an older woman who was disfigured. And she had kind of like buck teeth and what have you. And she was buried in the same cemetery. And they say that she died in a fire, and she was supposedly buried in the cemetery, and that you'll hear her screaming sometimes when we go to the cemetery at night. So yeah, I just thought it was fascinating. Now, interestingly enough, this guy that they did the interview with, the descendant, Mr. Guzman, he said that they can't explain it, but for some reason, this particular cemetery became so popular with like cults and doing witchcraft and stuff. Like, they have signs up everywhere. They have fence around it. The police go out and check it. He's like, we don't know why. We have no idea. Nothing about my family should bring people to that conclusion. And yet here we are. And I'm going to share a couple more stories. So there is this found fascinating, and it's called The Great Beast and Lily Gray. So Lily Gray was a woman who lived in Utah at the Salt Lake City Cemetery, and she lived in that area. And she was married to a guy who, by everything I've heard, was considered a nut. His name was Elmer Gray. Lily was the second wife of Elmer, and Elmer just had a really odd way of looking at the world. So his family thought he was nuts, but he was in jail. He went to jail. I can't tell you for what, but he wanted to get paroled. So he claimed in his parole application that he was kidnapped by 5 Democrats and their flunkies for something he said, and falsely imprisoned, and that his wife, I think he means the first wife, because he had been married twice, was also kidnapped. That's the word he uses, kidnapped. And that the grief of his parents for all that had happened is what killed them. And he blames all of this on these 5 Democrats and their flunkies. Now, he was in prison for 10 years, during which period of time Lily's family, her maiden family, decided they didn't want him and her to have anything to do with each other. So when she died of natural causes at the age of 77, they buried her in this particular cemetery. He was still alive and trying to still get out of prison at that point. He insisted, he had some money somewhere, because he insisted that he put the marker on her grave. And this is what the marker read. He says her name, and he says that she was killed by the beast. His exact quote at the bottom of her grave marker is, "Victim of the Great Beast 666. The family couldn't stop him from doing it because legally he was the next of kin. When he died 2 years later, her family went to his family and said, he was insane. We don't want her to have to go through eternity with him, bury him someplace else. They buried him on the far side of the same cemetery. And it is believed that Lily is still looking for him to this day. He didn't die until 1964. So this is not a story from like 150, 200 years ago. This is a fairly modern story. And well, I don't know.
As if you consider you or me fairly modern.
Oh, I mean, I'm still kicking. So are you. Yeah. I mean, comparatively, though, we're not talking something happened in the 1700s. We're talking something in the 20th century. Yes. And even the latter half of the 20th century. But I just found it a fascinating story. And nobody's ever taken the time or done the research to piece this guy's story together. You know, I don't know who he was talking about or what he was talking about, but there are some tantalizing little tidbits that would make a really interesting research project if somebody was so inclined. Because you never know these days. Now, I had a couple stories that I just wanted to share because I thought that they were really neat. There's a cemetery in the Netherlands where it's called the Old Cemetery at Roudermond in the Netherlands. And according to the religious law of the 19th century, Protestants and Catholics could not be buried in the same cemetery. There was a gentleman by the name of Colonel Adolfson, who was a Protestant, who died in 1880. His wife was a Catholic. And so she had to lose her. So their families came up with this unique, interesting thing. Bordering the old cemetery, the Protestant cemetery, is a Catholic cemetery. And it was agreed upon by all parties that they would bury half of them on the borderline between so that they could both be faithful to their faith and still be together. And they were buried. And there's a little marker which shows them holding hands through eternity. And I just thought that was an interesting story because you don't hear stories like that, you know, and realize how that was impactful. I did not know this. I'm going to give you guys a couple of little tidbits. In Savannah, at the Savannah International Airport, there they removed a cemetery to make the airport runways, except for one set of graves. Those are the graves of Richard and Catherine Dotson, who still are there. And they're like flush to the ground, but their little tombstones are still flat on the ground and you can read them. And they were buried in the late 1800s. And when they expanded the airport in World War II, they had to move the Dotson family cemetery, but the government agreed to leave this one couple, the original couple that started the whole thing, at rest. So now when people find out the story, they ask if the pilot will take them on a tour of the graveyard runway before they go into the air. And often pilots will ask if they can do so. I wanted to share this one because it was just insane. And this is the last one. This is the mausoleum of, hold on here, the mausoleum of Mary Read in the Evergreen Cemetery of Brooklyn, New York. So Jonathan Read lost his beloved wife, Mary, in 1893, heartbroken because they were a love match. He would visit his wife's grave in the Evergreen Cemetery every afternoon. He had her in a crypt above ground, and he would go into the crypt and sit by her casket. Over the course of time, he began to bring in Mary's favorite photos and paintings and all of this stuff and put them in there, her little treasures. And then he put a wood stove in, so when he sat there in the winter, he wouldn't freeze, so he could visit her year-round. That gets better. Eventually, he decided to move into the crypt, and the cemetery association allowed him to do so.
Oh, my.
He lived in the grave with her for 10 years.
That's unhealthy.
Just saying. And with that, I am done. But it's fascinating, the stories that I came up with, I thought.
Yeah, not all with ghosts. And if I got one takeaway, is if I'm ever in a cemetery, I'm going to take along a camp chair just so I don't accidentally sit in a mourning chair.
Please do. Yes, we don't want any curses.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I learned a lot about, you know, customs and norms in different areas and things like that. And planting the dead. Who knew?
A corpse garden.
Corpse garden.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for those.
You're welcome. So if anybody has any great ghost stories about, you know, cemeteries in your area, please share them with us. We'd love to hear them. And I could tell you literally probably about 20 stories from around this area, but I thought I would kind of travel all over the country. There are literally hundreds of these stories out there. Thank you, everybody, for listening and watching, and we truly do appreciate you.
Yes, thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.